track and narrow the heel in later versions. Back in New Zealand, meanwhile, an appalled Arthur Lydiard was watching the flashy exports flooding out of Oregon and wondering what in the world his friend was up to. Compared with Bowerman, Lydiard was by far the superior track mind. He'd coached many more Olympic champions and world record holders, and he'd created a training program that remains the gold standard. Lydiard liked Bill Bowerman and respected him as a coach, but good God, what was this junk he was selling? Lydiard knew all this pronation stuff was just marketing gibberish. If you told the average person of any age to take off his or her shoes and run down the hallway, you would almost always discover the foot action contains no hint of pronation or supination, Lydiard complained. Those sideways flexings of the ankles begin only when people lace themselves into these running shoes, because the construction of many of the shoes immediately alters the natural movement of the feet. We ran in canvas shoes, Lydiard went on. We didn't get plantar fascia. We didn't pronate or supinate. We might have lost a bit of skin from the rough canvas when we were running marathons, but generally speaking, we didn't have foot problems. Paying several hundred dollars for the latest in high-tech running shoes is no guarantee you'll avoid any of these injuries, and can even guarantee that you will suffer from them in one form or another. Eventually, even Bowerman was stricken by doubt. As Nike steamrolled along, churning out a bewildering variety of shoes and changing models every year for no reason besides having something else to sell, Bowerman felt his original mission of making an honest shoe had been eroded by a new ideology, which he summed up in two words: make money. Nike, he griped in a letter to a colleague, was distributing a lot of crap. Even to one of Nike's founding partners, it seemed, the words of the social critic Eric Hoffer were ringing true. Every great cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and turns into a racket. Bowerman had died by the time the Barefoot Uprising was taking hold in 2002, so Nike went back to Bowerman's old mentor to see if this shoeless stuff really had merit. "Of course," Arthur Lydiard reportedly snorted. "You support an area, it gets weaker. Use it extensively, it gets stronger. Run barefoot and you don't have all those troubles. Shoes that let your foot function like your barefoot, they're the shoes for me," Lydiard concluded. Nike followed up that blast with its own hard data. Jeff Pichotta, the senior researcher at Nike Sports Research Lab, assembled 20 runners on a grassy field and filmed them running barefoot. When he zoomed in, he was startled by what he found. Instead of each foot clomping down as it would in a shoe, it behaved like an animal with a mind of its own, stretching, grasping, seeking the ground with splayed toes, gliding in for a landing like a lake-bound swan. "It's beautiful to watch," a still spellbound Pichotta later told me. That made us start thinking that when you put a shoe on, it starts to take over some of the control. He immediately deployed his team to gather film of every existing barefoot culture they could find. "We found pockets of people all over the globe who are still running barefoot. And what you find is that during propulsion and landing, they have far more range of motion in the foot and engage more of the toe. Their feet flex, spread, splay, and grip the surface, meaning you have less pronation and more distribution of pressure." Faced with the almost inescapable conclusion that it had been selling lemons, Nike shifted into make lemonade mode. Jeff Pichotta became head of a top-secret and seemingly impossible project: finding a way to make a buck off a naked foot. It took 2 years of work before Pichotta was ready to unveil his masterpiece. It was presented to the world in TV ads that showed so many barefoot athletes — Kenyan marathoners padding along a dirt trail, swimmers curling their toes around a starting block, gymnasts and Brazilian capoeira dancers, and rock climbers and wrestlers and karate masters and beach soccer players — that after a while, it was hard to remember who does wear shoes or why. Flashing over the images were motivational messages. "Your feet are your foundation. Wake them up. Make them strong. Connect with the ground. Natural technology allows natural motion. Power to your feet." Across the sole of a bare foot is scrawled, "Performance starts here." Then comes the grand finale. As Tiptoe Through the Tulips crescendos in the background, we cut back to those Kenyans, whose bare feet are now sporting some kind of thin little shoe. It's the new Nike Free, a swooshed slipper even thinner than the old Cortez. And its slogan? Run barefoot. Chapter 26. Baby, this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run. Caballo Blanco's face was pink with pride, so I tried to think of something nice to say. We just arrived in Batopilas, an ancient mining town tucked 8,000 feet below the lip of the canyon. It was founded 400 years ago when Spanish explorers discovered silver ore in the Stony River, and it hasn't changed much since then. It's still a tiny strip of houses hugging the riverbank, a place where burros are as common as cars, and the first telephone was installed when the rest of the world was programming iPods. Getting down there took a cast-iron stomach and supreme faith in your fellow man, the man in question being the one driving the bus. The only way into Batopilas is a dirt road that corkscrews along the sheer face of a cliff, dropping 7,000 feet in less than 10 miles. As the bus strained around hairpin turns, we hung on tight and looked far below at the wrecks of cars whose drivers had miscalculated by a few inches. 2 years later, Caballo would make his own contribution to the steel cemetery when the pickup truck he was driving caught the lip of the cliff and tumbled over. Caballo managed to dive out just in time and watched as the truck exploded far below. Later, chunks of the scorched carcass were scavenged as good luck charms. After the bus pulled over on the edge of town, we climbed down stiffly, our faces as war-painted with dust and sweat salt as Caballo's had been the first time I met him. "There she is," Caballo hollered. "That's my place." We looked around, but the only thing in sight was the ancient ruin of an old mission across the river. Its roof was gone, and its red stone walls were collapsing into the ruddy canyon they'd been carved from, looking like a sandcastle dissolving back into sand. It was perfect. Caballo had found the ideal home for a living ghost. I could only imagine how freaky it must be to pass here at night and see his monstrous shadow dancing around behind his campfire as he wandered the ruins like Quasimodo. "Wow, that's really something, else," I said. "No, man," he said. "Over here." He pointed behind us toward a faint goat trail disappearing into the cactus. Caballo began to climb, and we fell in behind him, grabbing at brush for balance as we slipped and scrabbled up the stony path. "Damn, Caballo," Luis said. "This is the only driveway in the world that needs trail markers and an aid station at mile 2. After 100 yards or so, we came through a thicket of wild lime trees and found a small, clay-walled hut. Caballo had built it by hauling up rocks from the river, making the round trip over that treacherous path hundreds of times with river-slick stones in his hands. As a home, it suited Caballo even better than the ruined mission. Here in his handmade fortress of solitude, he could see everything in the river valley and remain unseen. We wandered inside and saw Caballo had a small camp bed, a pile of trashed sports sandals, and 3 or 4 books about Crazy Horse and other Native Americans on a shelf next to a kerosene lamp. That was it. No electricity, no running water, no toilet. Out back, Caballo had cut away the cactus and smoothed a little place to kick back after a run, smoke something relaxing, and gaze off at the prehistoric wilderness. Whatever Barefoot Ted's heavy Heidegger word was, no one was ever more an expression of their place than Caballo was of his hut. Caballo was anxious to get us fed and off his hands so he could catch up on sleep. The next few days were going to take everything we had, and none of us had gotten much rest since El Paso. He led us back down his hidden driveway and up the road to a tiny shop operating from the front window of a house. You poked your head in, and if shopkeeper Mario had what you wanted, you got it. Upstairs, Mario rented us a few small rooms with a cold water shower at the end of the hall. Caballo wanted us to dump our bags and head off immediately for food, but Barefoot Ted insisted on stripping down and padding off to the shower to sluice away the road grime. He came out screaming.
Jesus! The shower's got loose wires! I just got the shit shocked out of me!
Eric looked at me. You think Caballo did it? Justifiable homicide, I said. No jury would convict. The Barefoot Ted Caballo Blanco storm front hadn't improved a bit since we'd left Creel. During one rest stop, Caballo climbed down from the roof and squeezed his way into the back of the bus to escape.
That guy doesn't know what silence is, Caballo fumed. He's from L.A., man. He thinks you've got to fill every space with noise.
After we'd gotten settled at Mario's, Caballo brought us to another of his mamas. We didn't even have to order. As soon as we arrived, Doña Mila began pulling out whatever she had in the fridge. Soon, platters were being handed around of guacamole, frijoles, sliced cactus and tomatoes doused in tangy vinegar, Spanish rice, and a fragrant beef stew thickened with chicken liver.
Pack it in, Caballo had said. You're going to need it tomorrow.
He was taking us on a little warm-up hike, Caballo said. Just a jaunt up a nearby mountain to give us a taste of the terrain we'd be tackling on the trek to the racecourse. He kept saying it was no big deal, but then he'd warn us we'd better pound down the food and get right to bed. I became even more apprehensive after a white-haired old American ambled in and joined us.
How's the giddy-up, Hoss?
He greeted Caballo. His name was Bob Francis. He had first wandered down to Batopilas in the 60s, and part of him had never left. Even though he had kids and grandkids back in San Diego, Bob still spent most of the year wandering the canyons around Batopilas, sometimes guiding trekkers, sometimes just visiting Patricio Luna, a Tarahumara friend who was Manuel Luna's uncle. They met 30 years before, when Bob got lost in the canyons. Patricio found him, fed him, and brought him back to his family's cave for the night. Because of his long friendship with Patricio, Bob is one of the only Americans to have ever attended a Tarahumara Tesquinada, the marathon drinking party that precedes and occasionally prevents the ball races. Even Caballo hasn't reached that level of trust with the Tarahumara, and after listening to Bob's stories, he wasn't sure he wanted to.
All of a sudden, Tarahumara I've been friends with for years, guys I knew as shy, gentle amigos, are in my face, butting against me with their chests, spitting insults at me, ready to fight, Bob said. Meanwhile, their wives are in the bushes with other men, and their grown-up daughters are wrestling naked. They keep the kids away from these deals. You can imagine why.
Anything goes at a Tesquinada, Bob explained, because everything is blamed on the peyote, moonshine tequila, and tesquino, the potent corn beer. As wild as these parties get, they actually serve a noble and sober purpose. They act as a pressure valve to vent explosive emotions. Just like the rest of us, the Tarahumara have secret desires and grievances. But in a society where everyone relies on one another and there are no police to get between them, there has to be a way to satisfy lusts and grudges. What better than a booze fest? Everyone gets ripped, goes wild, and then, chastened by bruises and hangovers, they dust themselves off and get on with their lives. I could have been married or murdered 20 times before the night was over, Bob said. But I was smart enough to put down the gourd and get myself out of there before the real shenanigans started. If one outsider knew the Barrancas as well as Caballo, it was Bob, which was why, even though he was liquored up and in a bit of a ranting mood, I paid careful attention when he got into it with Ted.
Those fucking things are going to be dead tomorrow, Bob said, pointing at the five fingers on Ted's feet.
I'm not going to wear them, Ted said.
Now you're talking sense, Bob said.
I'm going barefoot, Ted said.
Bob turned to Caballo.
He messing with us, Hoss?
Caballo just smiled. Early the next morning, Caballo came for us as dawn was breaking over the canyon.
That's where we're headed tomorrow, Caballo said, pointing through the window of my room toward a mountain rearing in the distance.
Between us and the mountain was a sea of rolling foothills so thickly overgrown that it was hard to see how a trail could punch through. We'll run one of those little guys this morning. How much water do we need? Scott asked.
I only carry this, Caballo said, waving a 16-ounce plastic bottle. There's a freshwater spring up top to refill.
Food?
Nah, Caballo shrugged as he and Scott left to check on the others. We'll be back by lunch.
I'm bringing the big boy, Eric said to me, gurgling spring water into the bladder on his 96-ounce hydration backpack. I think you should, too.
Really?
Caballo says we're only going about 10 miles.
Can't hurt to carry the max when you go off-road, Eric said.
Even if you don't need it, it's training for when you do. And you never know. Something happens, you could be out there longer than you think.
I put down my handheld bottle and reached for my hydration pack.
Bring iodine pills in case you need to purify water. And shove in some gels, too, Eric added. On race day, you're going to need 200 calories an hour. The trick is learning how to take in a little at a time, so you've got a steady drip of fuel without overwhelming your stomach. This'll be good practice.
We walked through Batopilas, past shopkeepers hand-sprinkling water on the stones to keep the dust down. School kids in spotless white shirts, their black hair sleek with water, interrupted their chatter to politely wish us, Buenos dias.
Gonna be a hot one, Caballo said, as we ducked into a storefront with no sign out front.
¿Hay teléfono? He asked the woman who greeted us. Are the phones working?
Todavía no,
she said, shaking her head in resignation. Not yet.
Clarita had the only two public phones in all Batopilas, but service had been knocked out for the past 3 days, leaving shortwave radio the only form of communication. For the first time, it hit me how cut off we were. We had no way of knowing what was going on in the outside world, or letting the outside world know what was happening to us. We were putting a hell of a lot of trust in Caballo, and once again, I had to wonder why. As knowledgeable as Caballo was, it still seemed crazy to put our lives in the hands of a guy who didn't seem too concerned about his own. But for the moment, the grumble of my stomach and the aroma of Clarita's breakfast managed to push those thoughts aside. Clarita served up big plates of huevos rancheros, the fried eggs smothered in homemade salsa and freshly chopped cilantro, and sitting atop thick, hand-padded tortillas. The food was too delicious to wolf down, so we lingered, refilling our coffee a few times before getting up to go. Eric and I followed Scott's example and tucked an extra tortilla in our pockets for later. Only after we finished did I realize that the party kids hadn't shown up. I checked my watch. It was already pushing 10 a.m.
We're leaving them, Caballo said.
I'll run back for them, Luis offered.
No, Caballo said. They could still be in bed. We've got to hit it if we're going to dodge the afternoon heat.
Maybe it was for the best. They could use a day to rehydrate and power up for the hike tomorrow.
No matter what, don't let them try to follow us, Caballo told Luis's father, who was staying behind.
They get lost out there, we'll never see them again. That's no joke.
Eric and I cinched tight our hydration packs, and I pulled a bandana over my head. It was already steamy. Caballo slid through a gap in the retaining wall and began picking his way over the boulders to the edge of the river. Barefoot Ted pushed ahead to join him, showing off how nimbly he could hop from rock to rock in his bare feet. If Caballo was impressed, he wasn't showing it.
You guys! Hold up!
Jen and Billy were sprinting down the street behind us. Billy had his shirt in his hand, and Jen's shoelaces were untied.
You sure you want to come? Scott asked when they panted up. You haven't even eaten anything.
Jen tore a power bar in two and gave half to Billy. They were each carrying a skinny water bottle that couldn't have held more than 6 swallows.
We're good, Billy said.
We followed the stony riverbank for a mile, then turned into a dry gully. Without a word, we all spontaneously broke into a trot. The gully was wide and sandy, leaving plenty of room for Scott and Barefoot Ted to flank Caballo and run 3 abreast.
Check out their feet, said Eric. Even though Scott was in the Brooks trail shoe he'd helped design and Caballo was in sandals, they both skimmed their feet over the ground just the way Ted did in his bare feet,
their foot strikes in perfect sync. It was like watching a team of Lipizzaner stallions circle the show ring. After about a mile, Caballo veered onto a steep, rocky washout that climbed up into the mountain. Eric and I eased back to a walk, obeying the ultra runner's creed. If you can't see the top, walk. When you're running 50 miles, there's no dividend in bashing up the hills and then being winded on the way down. You only lose a few seconds if you walk, and then you can make them back up by flying downhill. Eric believes that's one reason ultra runners don't get hurt and never seem to burn out. They know how to train, not strain. As we walked, we caught up with Barefoot Ted. He'd had to slow down to pick his way over the jagged, fist-sized stones. I squinted up at the trail ahead. We had at least another mile of crumbly rock to climb before the trail leveled and hopefully smoothed. "Ted, where are your five fingers?" I asked. "Don't need them," he said. "I made a deal with Caballo that if I handled this hike, he wouldn't get mad anymore if I went barefoot." "He rigged the bet," I said. "This is like running up the side of a gravel pit." "Humans didn't invent rough surfaces, Oso," Ted said. "We invented the smooth ones. Your foot is perfectly happy molding itself around rocks. All you've got to do is relax and let your foot flex. It's like a foot massage." "Oh, hey," he called after us as Eric and I pulled ahead. "Here's a great tip. Next time your feet are sore, walk on slippery stones in a cold creek. Unbelievable." Eric and I left Ted singing to himself as he hopped and trotted along. The glare off the stones was blinding, and heat kept rising, making it feel as if we were climbing straight into the sun. In a way, we were. After 2 miles, I checked the altimeter on my watch and saw we'd climbed over 1,000 feet. Soon, though, the trail plateaued and softened from stones to foot-worn dirt. The others were a few hundred yards ahead, so Eric and I started to run to close the gap. Before we caught them, Barefoot Ted came whisking by. "Time for a drink," he said, waving his empty water bottle. "I'll wait for you guys at the spring." The trail veered abruptly upward again, jagging back and forth in lightning bolt switchbacks. 1,500 feet? 2,000? We bent into the slope, feeling as though we only gained a few inches every step. After 3 hours and 6 miles of hard climbing, we hadn't hit the spring. We hadn't seen shade since we left the riverbank. "See?" Eric said, waving the nozzle of his hydration pack. "Those guys have got to be parched." "And starving," I added, ripping open a raw food granola bar. At 3,500 feet, we found Caballo and the rest of the crew waiting in a hollow under a juniper tree. "Anyone need iodine pills?" I asked. "Don't think so," Luis said. "Take a look." Under the tree was a natural stone basin carved out by centuries of cool, trickling spring water. Except there was no water. "We're in a drought," Caballo said. "I forgot about that." But there was a chance another spring might be flowing a few hundred feet higher up the mountain. Caballo volunteered to run up and check. Jen, Billy, and Luis were too thirsty to wait and went with him. Ted gave his bottle to Luis to fill up for him and sat to wait in the shade with us. I gave him a few sips from my pack while Scott shared some pita and hummus. "You don't use goos?" Eric asked. "I like real food," Scott said. "It's just as portable, and you get real calories, not just a fast burn." As a corporate-sponsored elite athlete, Scott had the worldwide buffet of nutrition at his fingertips. But after experimenting with the entire spectrum, everything from deer meat to Happy Meals to organic raw food bars, he'd ended up with a diet a lot like the Tarahumara. "Growing up in Minnesota, I used to be a total junk eater," he said. "Lunch used to be 2 McChickens and large fries." When he was a Nordic skier and cross-country runner in high school, his coaches were always telling him he needed plenty of lean meat to rebuild his muscles after a tough workout. Yet the more Scott researched traditional endurance athletes, the more vegetarians he found. Like the marathon monks in Japan he'd just been reading about. They ran an ultramarathon every day for 7 years, covering some 25,000 miles on nothing but miso soup, tofu, and vegetables. And what about Percy Cerruti, the mad Australian genius who coached some of the greatest milers of all time?
Cerruti believed food shouldn't even be cooked, let alone slaughtered. He put his athletes through triple sessions on a diet of raw oats, fruit, nuts, and cheese. Even Cliff Young, the 63-year-old farmer who stunned Australia in 1983 by beating the best ultra-runners in the country in a 507-mile race from Sydney to Melbourne, did it all on beans, beer, and oatmeal. "I used to feed the calves by hand, and they thought I was their mother," Young said. "I couldn't sleep too good those nights when I knew they would get slaughtered." He switched to grains and potatoes and slept a whole lot better. Ran pretty good, too. Scott wasn't sure why meatless diets worked for history's great runners, but he figured he'd trust the results first and figure out the science later. From that point on, no animal products would pass his lips. No eggs, no cheese, not even ice cream. And not much sugar or white flour, either. He stopped carrying Snickers and power bars during his long runs. Instead, he loaded a fanny pack with rice burritos, pita stuffed with hummus and Kalamata olives, and home-baked bread smeared with adzuki beans and quinoa spread. When he sprained his ankle, he eschewed ibuprofen and relied instead on wolfsbane and whopping portions of garlic and ginger. "Sure, I had my doubts," Scott said. "Everyone told me I'd get weaker. I wouldn't recover between workouts. I'd get stress fractures and anemia. But I found that I actually feel better because I'm eating foods with more high-quality nutrients. And after I won Western States, I never looked back." By basing his diet on fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, Scott is deriving maximum nutrition from the lowest possible number of calories, so his body isn't forced to carry or process any useless bulk. And because carbohydrates clear the stomach faster than protein, it's easier to jam a lot of workout time into his day, since he doesn't have to sit around waiting for a meatball sub to settle. Vegetables, grains, and legumes contain all the amino acids necessary to build muscle from scratch. Like a tarahumara runner, he's ready to go any distance, anytime. Unless, of course, he runs out of water.
"Not good, guys," Luis called as he trotted back down. "That one's dry, too."
He was getting worried. He'd just tried to piss, and after 4 hours of sweating in 95-degree heat, it came out looking like convenience store coffee.
"I think we should run for it."
Scott and Caballo agreed.
"If we open it up, we'll be down in an hour," Caballo said. "Also," he asked me, "you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine," I said, "and we're still packing water."
"All right, let's do it," Barefoot Ted said.
We began running single file down the trail, Caballo and Scott up front. Barefoot Ted was amazing. He was speeding down the mountain hard on the heels of Luis and Scott, two of the best downhillers in the sport. With all that talent pushing up against each other, the pace was getting ferocious.
"Yeah, baby!" Jen and Billy were hollering.
"Let's hang back," Eric said. "We're going to crash if we try to hang with them."
We settled into an easy lope, falling far behind as the others slashed back and forth down the switchbacks. Running downhill can trash your quads, not to mention snap your ankle, so the trick is to pretend you're running uphill. Keep your feet spinning under your body like you're a lumberjack rolling a log, and control your speed by leaning back and shortening your stride. By mid-afternoon, the heat had bottled up in the canyon until it was over 100 degrees. We'd lost sight of the others, so Eric and I took our time, running easily and sipping often from our quickly emptying hydration packs, feeling our way carefully down the confusing web of trails, unaware that an hour before, Jen and Billy had vanished.
"Goat's blood is good," Billy kept insisting. "We can drink the blood, then eat the meat. Goat meat is good."
He'd read a book by a guy whose trick for cheating death in the Arizona desert was to stone a wild horse to death and suck the blood from its throat.
"Geronimo used to do that too," Billy thought. "Wait, it might have been Kit Carson."
"Drink the blood?"
Jen, her throat so parched it hurt to talk, just stared at him.
"He's losing it," she thought.
"We can barely walk, and Bonehead's talking about killing a goat we can't catch with a knife we don't have. He's in worse shape than I am. He's..." Suddenly, her stomach clenched so badly she could barely breathe. She got it. Billy didn't sound crazy because of the heat. He sounded crazy because the only sane thing left to talk about was the one thing he wouldn't admit. There was no way out of this. On a good day, no one in the world could have dropped Jen and Billy on a measly 6-mile trail run, but this was turning out to be a pretty bad day. The heat, their hangovers, and their empty stomachs had caught up with them before they'd made it halfway down the mountain. They lost sight of Caballo on one of the switchbacks, then they hit a fork in the trail. Next thing they knew, they were alone. Disoriented, Jen and Billy wandered off the mountain and into a stone maze that webbed in every direction. The rock walls were mirroring the heat so hideously, Jen suspected she and Billy were just going whichever way looked a little shadier. Jen felt dizzy, as if her mind were floating free of her body. They hadn't eaten since splitting that power bar 6 hours before, and hadn't had a sip of water since noon. Even if heatstroke didn't wipe them out, Jen knew, they were still doomed. The 100-plus degree heat would drop, but keep on dropping. Come nightfall, they'd be shivering in the freezing dark in their surf shorts and t-shirts, dying of thirst and exposure in one of the most unreachable corners of Mexico. What weird corpses they'd make, Jen thought as they trudged along. Whoever found them would have to wonder how a pair of 22-year-old lifeguards and surf baggies ended up at the bottom of a Mexican canyon, looking like they'd been tossed in from Baja by a rogue wave. Jen had never been so thirsty in her life. She'd lost 12 pounds during a 100-mile race before and still didn't feel as desperate as she did now. Look! The luck of the bonehead, Jen marveled. Under a stone ledge, Billy had spotted a pool of fresh water. They ran toward it, fumbling the tops off their water bottles, then stopped. The water wasn't water. It was black mud and green scum, buzzing with flies and churned by wild goats and burros. Jen bent down for a closer look. Ugh! The smell was nasty. They knew what one sip could do. Come nightfall, they could be too weak with fever and diarrhea to walk, or infected with cholera, or giardia, or guinea worm disease, which has no cure except slowly pulling the 3-foot-long worms out of the abscesses that erupt on your skin and eye sockets. But they knew what would happen without that sip. Jen had just read about those two best friends who'd gotten lost in a canyon in New Mexico and became so sun-crazed after a single day without water that one stabbed the other to death. She'd seen photos of hikers who'd been found in Death Valley with their mouths choked with dirt, their last moments alive spent trying to suck moisture from scorching sand. She and Billy could stay away from the puddle and die of thirst, or they could swallow a few gulps and risk dying from something else. "Let's hold off," Billy said. "If we don't find our way out in 1 hour, we'll come back." "Okay. This way?" she said, pointing away from Batopilas and straight toward a wilderness that stretched 400 miles to the Sea of Cortez. Billy shrugged. They'd been too rushed and groggy that morning to pay attention to where they were going. Not that it would have mattered. Everything looked exactly the same. As they walked, Jen flashed back to the way she'd scoffed at her mother the night before she and Billy had left for El Paso. "Jen," her mother had implored, "you don't know these people. How do you know they'll take care of you if something goes wrong?" Dang, Jen thought. Mom nailed that one. "How long's it been?" she asked Billy. "About 10 minutes. I can't wait anymore. Let's go back." "All right." When they found the puddle again, Jen was ready to drop to her knees and start slurping, but Billy held her back. He swirled aside the mold, covered the open mouth of his water bottle with his hand, then filled it from the bottom of the puddle, half hoping the water would be a little less bacteria-ridden beneath the muck. He handed his bottle to Jen, then filled hers the same way. "I always knew you'd kill me," Jen said. They clinked their bottles, said cheers, and started to gulp, trying not to gag. They drank their bottles dry, refilled them, and started walking west again into the wilderness. Before they'd gotten far, they noticed deep shadows were stretching farther across the canyon. We've got to get more water, Billy said. He hated the idea of backtracking, but their only chance of surviving through the night was getting to the puddle and hunkering down till dawn. Maybe if they chugged 3 bottles full of water, they'd be hydrated enough to climb up the mountain for a last look around before dark. They turned and, once again, trudged back into the maze.
Billy, Jen said, we're really in trouble.
Billy didn't answer. His head was killing him, and he couldn't shake a line from Howl that kept beating in time to the throbbing in his skull. Who disappeared into the volcanoes of Mexico, leaving behind nothing but the shadow of dungarees and the lava and ash of poetry. Disappeared in Mexico, Billy thought, leaving nothing behind.
Billy, Jen repeated.
They'd put each other through some bad times in the past, she and the bonehead, but they'd found a way to stop breaking each other's hearts and become best friends. She'd gotten Billy into this, and she felt worse for what was about to happen to him than what would happen to her.
This is for real, Billy, Jen said. Tears began trickling down her face. We're going to die out here. We're going to die today.
Shut up!
Billy screamed, so rattled by the sight of Jen's tears that he erupted in a total non-bonehead frenzy.
Just shut up!
The outburst stunned both of them into silence. And in that silence, they heard a sound. Rocks clattering somewhere behind them.
Hey! Jen and Billy shouted together. Hey! Hey! Hey!
They began running before realizing that they didn't know what they were running toward. Caballo had warned them that if they faced one danger out there greater than being lost, it was being found. Jen and Billy froze, trying to peer into the shadows below the canyon's crest. Could it be the Tarahumara? A Tarahumara hunter would be invisible, Caballo had told them. He'd watch from a distance, and if he didn't like what he saw, he'd disappear back into the forest. What if it was drug cartel enforcers? Whoever it was, they had to risk it.
Hey! They shouted. Who's there?
They listened until the last echo of their voices died away. Then a shadow split from the canyon wall and began moving toward them.
You hear that?
Eric asked me. It had taken us 2 hours to pick our way down the mountain. We'd kept losing the trail and had to stop to backtrack and search our memories for landmarks before continuing. Wild goats had turned the mountain into a web of faint, crisscrossing trails, and with the sun fading below the canyon lip, it was getting hard to keep track of which direction we were going. Finally, we spotted a dry creek bed down below that I was pretty sure led to the river. Just in time, too. I'd finished my water half an hour before and was already pasty-mouthed. I broke into a jog, but Eric called me back. Let's make sure, he said. He climbed back up the cliff to check our bearings.
Looks good, he called.
He started to climb down, and that's when he heard voices echoing from somewhere inside the gorges. He called me up, and together we began following the echoes. A few moments later, we found Jen and Billy. Tears were still streaking Jen's face. Eric gave them his water while I handed them the last of my goose.
You really drank out of that? I asked, looking at the wild burrow dung in the puddle and hoping they'd confused it with another one.
Yeah, Jen said. We were just coming back for more.
I dug out my camera in case an infectious disease specialist wanted to see exactly what had gotten into their bowels. Foul as it was, though, that puddle had saved their lives. If Jen and Billy hadn't come back for another drink at precisely that moment, they'd still be walking deeper and deeper into no man's land, the canyon walls closing behind them.
Can you run a little more? I asked Jen. I think we're not that far from the village.
Okay, Jen said. We set off at an easy trot, but as the water and goo revived them, Jen and Billy set a pace I could barely keep up with. Once again, I was amazed at their ability to bounce back from the dead. Eric led us down the creek bed, then spotted a bend in the gorge he recognized. We dog-legged left, and even with the light getting dim, I could see that the dust ahead of us had been tromped by feet. A mile and a half later, we emerged from the gorges to find Scott and Luis waiting anxiously for us on the outskirts of Batopilas. We got 4 liters of water from a little grocery store and dumped in a handful of iodine pills. "I don't know if it will work," Eric said, "but maybe you can flush out whatever bacteria you swallowed." Jen and Billy sat on the curb and began gulping. While they drank, Scott explained that no one had noticed that Jen and Billy were missing until the rest of the group had gotten off the mountain. By then, everyone was so dangerously dehydrated that turning back to search would have put them all in danger. Caballo grabbed a bottle of water and went back on his own, urging the others to sit tight. The last thing he wanted was for all his gringos to go scattering into the canyons at nightfall. About half an hour later, Caballo ran back into Batopilas, red-faced and drenched in sweat. He'd missed us in the branching gorges, and when he realized the hopelessness of his one-man search party, he'd returned to town for help. He looked at Eric and me, tired but still on our feet, and then at the 2 ace-young ultra-runners, exhausted and distraught on the curb. I could tell what Caballo was thinking before he said it. "What's your secret, man?" he asked Eric, nodding toward me. "How'd you fix this guy?" Chapter 27. I'd met Eric the year before, right after I'd thrown off my running shoes in disgust and sprawled in an icy creek. I was hurt again, and for the last time, as far as I was concerned. As soon as I'd gotten home from the Barrancas, I'd started putting Caballo's lessons to work. I couldn't wait to lace up my shoes every afternoon and try to recapture the sensation I'd had in the hills of Creel, back when running behind Caballo made the miles feel so easy, light, smooth, and fast that I never wanted to stop. As I ran, I screened my mental film footage of Caballo in action, remembering the way he'd floated up the hills of Creel as if he were being abducted by aliens. Somehow keeping everything relaxed except those bony elbows, which pumped for power like a rock'em sock'em robot. For all his gangliness, Caballo on a trail reminded me of Muhammad Ali in the ring, loose as wave-washed seaweed, with just a hint of ferocity ready to explode. After 2 months, I'd built up to 6 miles a day, with a 10-miler on the weekend. My form hadn't graduated to smooth yet, but I was keeping the needle wavering pretty steadily between easy and light. I was getting a little anxious, though. No matter how gingerly I tried to take it, my legs were already starting to rebel. That little flamethrower in my right foot was shooting out sparks, and the backs of both calves felt twangy, as if my Achilles tendons had been replaced with piano wire. I stocked up on stretching books and put in a dutiful half hour of loosening up before every run, but the long shadow of Dr. Torg's cortisone needle loomed over me. By late spring, the time had come for a test. Thanks to a forest ranger friend, I lucked into the perfect opportunity, a 3-day, 50-mile running trip through Idaho's River of No Return, 2.5 million acres of the most untouched wilderness in the continental U.S. The setup was perfect. Our supplies would be hauled by a mule packer, so all that I and the other 4 runners had to do was kick up 15 miles of dirt a day from campsite to campsite. "I really didn't know anything about the woods till I came to Idaho," Jenny Blake began, as she led us down a thin wisp of a dirt trail winding through the junipers. Watching her flow over the trail with such teenage strength, it was hard to believe that nearly 20 years had passed since her arrival. At 38, Jenny still has the blonde bangs, winsome blue eyes, and lean tan limbs of a college frosh on summer break. Oddly, though, she's more of a carefree kid now than she was back then. I was bulimic in college and had a terrible self-image until I found myself out here, Jenny said. She came as a summer volunteer and was immediately loaded with a lumberjack saw and 2 weeks of food and pointed toward the backcountry to go clear trails. She nearly buckled under the weight of the backpack, but she kept her doubts to herself and set off, alone, into the woods. At dawn, she'd pull on sneakers and nothing else, then set off for long runs through the woods, the rising sun warming her naked body.
I'd be out here for weeks at a time by myself, Jenny explained. No one could see me, so I just go and go and go. It was the most fantastic feeling you can imagine. She didn't need a watch or a route. She judged her speed by the tickle of wind on her skin and kept racing along the pine-needled trails until her legs and lungs begged her to head back to camp. Jenny has been hardcore ever since, running long miles even when Idaho is blanketed by snow. Maybe she's self-medicating against deep-seated problems, but maybe, to paraphrase Bill Clinton, there was never anything wrong with Jenny that couldn't be fixed by what's right with Jenny. Yet, when I winced my way down the final downhill leg 3 days later, I could barely walk. I hobbled into the creek and sat there, simmering and wondering what was wrong with me. It had taken me 3 days to run the same distance as Caballo's race course, and I'd ended up with one Achilles tear, maybe two, and a pain in my heel that felt suspiciously like the vampire bite of running injuries, plantar fasciitis. Once PF sinks its fangs into your heels, you're in danger of being infected for life. Check any running-related message board, and you're guaranteed to find a batch of beseeching threads from PF sufferers begging for a cure. Everyone is quick to suggest the same remedies: night splints, elastic socks, ultrasound, electroshock, cortisone, orthotics. But the messages keep coming because none of them really seems to work. But how come Caballo could hammer descents longer than the Grand Canyon in crappy old sandals, while I couldn't manage a few easy months of miles without a major breakdown? Wilt Chamberlain, all 7 feet 1 inch and 275 pounds of him, had no problem running a 50-mile ultra when he was 60 years old, after his knees had survived a lifetime of basketball. Hell, a Norwegian sailor named Mensen Ernst barely even remembered what dry land felt like when he came ashore back in 1832, but he still managed to run all the way from Paris to Moscow to win a bet, averaging 130 miles a day for 14 days, wearing God only knows what kind of clodhoppers on God only knows what kind of roads. And Mensen was just cracking his knuckles before getting down to serious business. He then ran from Constantinople to Calcutta, trotting 90 miles a day for 2 straight months. Not that he didn't feel it. Mensen had to rest 3 whole days before beginning the 5,400-mile jog back home. So how come Mensen never got plantar fasciitis? He couldn't have, because his legs were in excellent shape a year later when dysentery killed him as he tried to run all the way to the source of the Nile. Everywhere I looked, little pockets of super-running savants seemed to emerge from the shadows. Just a few miles away from me in Maryland, 13-year-old Mackenzie Ryford was happily running the JFK 50-miler with her mom. It was fun. While Jack Kirk, a.k.a. the Dipsy Demon, was still running the hellacious Dipsy Trail Race at age 96. The race begins with a 671-step cliffside climb, which means a man nearly half as old as America was climbing a 50-story staircase before running off into the woods. "You don't stop running because you get old," said the demon. "You get old because you stop running." So what was I missing? I was in worse shape now than when I'd started. Not only couldn't I race with the Tarahumara, I doubted my PF-inflamed feet could even get me to the starting line. "You're like everyone else," Eric Orton told me. "You don't know what you're doing." A few weeks after my Idaho debacle, I'd gone to interview Eric for a magazine assignment. As an adventure sports coach in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and the former fitness director for the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, Eric's specialty is tearing endurance sports down to their integral movements and finding transferable skills. He'd study rock climbing to find shoulder techniques for kayakers and apply Nordic skiing's smooth propulsion to mountain biking. What he's really looking for are basic engineering principles. He's convinced that the next great advance in fitness will come not from training or technology, but technique. The athlete who avoids injury will be the one who leaves the competition behind. He'd read my article about Caballo and the Tarahumara and was intensely curious to hear more.
What the Tarahumara do is pure body art, he said. No one else on the planet has made such a virtue out of self-propulsion. Eric had been fascinated with the Tarahumara since an athlete he'd trained for Leadville returned with amazing stories about fantastic Indians flying through the druidic dusk in sandals and robes. Eric scoured libraries for books on the Tarahumara, but all he found were some anthropological texts from the 50s and an amateur account by a husband and wife team who traveled through Mexico in their camper. It was a mystifying gap in sports literature. Distance running is the world's number one participation sport, but almost nothing had been written about its number one practitioners. Everyone thinks they know how to run, but it's really as nuanced as any other activity, Eric told me. Ask most people, and they'll say, people just run the way they run. That's ridiculous. Does everyone just swim the way they swim? For every other sport, lessons are fundamental. You don't go out and start slashing away with a golf club or sliding down a mountain on skis until someone takes you through the steps and teaches you proper form. If not, inefficiency is guaranteed and injury is inevitable. Running is the same way, Eric explained. Learn it wrong, and you'll never know how good it can feel. He grilled me for details about the race I'd seen at the Tarahumara school. The little wooden ball, he mused. The way they learn to run by kicking it, that can't be an accident. Then he offered me a deal. He'd get me ready for Caballo's race, and in return, I'd vouch for him with Caballo. If this race comes off, we have to be there, Eric urged. It'll be the greatest ultra of all time. I just don't think I'm built for running 50 miles, I said. Everyone is built for running, he said. Every time I up my miles, I break down. You won't this time. Should I get the orthotics? Forget the orthotics. I was dubious, but Eric's absolute confidence was winning me over. I should probably cut weight first to make it easier on my legs. Your diet will change all by itself. Wait and see. How about yoga? That'll help, yeah? Forget yoga. Every runner I know who does yoga gets hurt. This was sounding better all the time. You really think I can do it? Here's the truth, Eric said. You've got zero margin of error, but you can do it. I'd have to forget everything I knew about running and start over from the beginning. Get ready to go back in time, Eric said. You're going tribal. A few weeks later, a man with a right leg twisted below the knee limped toward me, carrying a rope. He looped the rope around my waist and pulled it taut. Go! He shouted. I bent against the rope, churning my legs as I dragged him forward. He released the rope, and I shot off. Good, the man said. Whenever you run, remember that feeling of straining against the rope. It'll keep your feet under your body, your hips driving straight ahead, and your heels out of the picture. Eric had recommended I begin my tribal makeover by heading down to Virginia to apprentice myself to Ken Mirick, an exercise physiologist and world champion triathlete whose muscular dystrophy forced him to squeeze every possible bit of economy out of his running style. I'm living proof of God's sense of humor, Ken likes to say. I was an obese kid with a drop foot whose dad lived for sports. So as an overweight Jerry's kid, I was way slower than everyone I ever played against. I learned to examine everything and find a better way. In basketball, Ken couldn't drive the lane, so he practiced three-pointers and a deadly hook shot. He couldn't chase a quarterback or shake a safety, but he studied body angles and lines of attack and became a formidable left tackle. He couldn't out-sprint a cross-court volley, so in tennis, he developed a ferocious serve and service return. If I couldn't outrun you, I'd outthink you, he says. I'd find your weakness and make it my strength. Because of the withered calf muscles in his right leg, when he began to compete in triathlons, Ken could only run with a heavy shoe he'd built from a rollerblade boot and a leaf spring. That put him at a substantial weight disadvantage to the amputee athletes in the physically challenged division, so ramping up his energy efficiency to compensate for his 7-pound shoes could make a huge difference. Ken got a stack of videos of Kenyan runners and ran through them frame by frame. After hours of viewing, he was struck by a revelation. The greatest marathoners in the world run like kindergartners. Watch kids at a playground running around. Their feet land right under them and they push back, Ken said. Kenyans do the same thing. The way they ran barefoot growing up is astonishingly similar to how they run now, and astonishingly different from how Americans run. Grabbing a pad and pen, Ken went back through the tapes and jotted down all the components of a Kenyan stride. Then he went looking for guinea pigs. Fortunately, Ken had already begun doing physiological testing on triathletes as part of his kinesiology studies at Virginia Polytechnic, so that gave him access to a lot of athletes to experiment on. Runners would have been resistant to having someone tinker with their stride, but Ironmen are up for anything. Triathletes are very forward-thinking, Ken explains. It's a young sport, so it's not mired in tradition. Back in 1988, triathletes started to use aero bars on their bikes, and cyclists mocked them mercilessly, until Greg LeMond used one and won the Tour de France by 8 seconds. Ken's first test subject was Alan Melvin, a world-class masters triathlete in his 60s. First, Ken set a baseline by having Melvin run 400 meters full out. Then he clipped a small electric metronome to his t-shirt. What's this for? Set it for 180 beats a minute, then run to the beat. Why? Kenyans have super quick foot turnover, Ken said. Quick, light leg contractions are more economical than big, forceful ones. I don't get it, Alan said. Don't I want a longer stride, not a shorter one? Let me ask you this, Ken replied. You ever see one of those barefoot guys in a 10K race? Yeah, it's like they're running on hot coals. You ever beat one of those barefoot guys? Alan reflected. Good point. After practicing for 5 months, Alan came back for another round of testing. He ran 4 1-mile repeats, and every lap of the track was faster than his previous 400-meter best. This was someone who'd been running for 40 years and was already top 10 in his age group, Ken pointed out. This wasn't the improvement of a beginner. In fact, as a 62-year-old athlete, he should have been declining. Ken was working on himself as well. He'd been such a weak runner that in his best triathlon to date, he'd come off the bike with a 10-minute lead and still lost. Within a year of creating his new technique in 1997, Ken became unbeatable, winning the World Disabled Championship the next 2 years in a row. Once word got out that Ken had figured out a way to run that was not only fast but gentle on the legs, other triathletes began hiring him as their coach. Ken went on to train 11 national champions and built up a roster of more than 100 athletes. Convinced that he'd rediscovered an ancient art, Ken named his style evolution running. Coincidentally, two other barefoot-style running methods were popping up around the same time. Qi running, based on the balance and minimalism of Tai Chi, began taking off in San Francisco, while Dr. Nicholas Romanoff, a Russian exercise physiologist based in Florida, was teaching his pose method. The surge in minimalism did not arise through copying or cross-pollination. Instead, it seemed to be testament to the urgent need for a response to the running injury epidemic and the pure mechanical logic of, as Barefoot Ted would call it, the bricolage of barefooting, the elegance of a less is more cure. But a simple system isn't necessarily simple to learn, as I found out when Ken Murick filmed me in action. My mind was registering easy, light, and smooth, but the video showed I was still bobbing up and down while bending forward like I was leaning into a hurricane. My ease with Caballo's style, Ken explained, had been my mistake. When I teach this technique and ask someone how it feels, if they say, great, I go, damn. That means they didn't change a thing. The change should be awkward. You should go through a period where you're no longer good at doing it wrong and not yet good at doing it right. You're not only adapting your skills, but your tissues. You're activating muscles that have been dormant most of your life.